Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday afternoon. The presidential race in the United States seems to be starting already. It started months ago, but now we're getting candidates who are officially running for president with today's announcement from Senator Rand Paul that he is running for president. Ted Cruz did the same, what was it, last week, and we'll have many more in the weeks ahead. We were thinking about other countries in the world. We seem to be the only country that has these races that go on for years at a time, and we spend billions of dollars. So we were looking at Britain because they have an election coming up. Theirs is every 5 years, and they don't spend nearly the amount of money that we do. And the election time period is not very long. In May 7th is the UK general election. They will be electing the 56th Parliament. And so we thought we would go to Britain to find out how things are done there and why it is that everybody else seems to have a reasonable period of time for an election where we go way overboard. So that's what we're going to do this hour of the program. Special emphasis on what's going on in Britain. But we'll also look at what may be happening in other countries in the world. Our guest this hour is Dr. Darren Liliker. He is Associate Professor of Political Communication at Bournemouth University. He's the author of Political Communication and Cognition. He's researched and published widely on the topics of political marketing and political communication within digital environments and exploring and understanding patterns of political participation in the digital age. He will be up. Those of you who are following the elections in England will be very interested in what he has to say because he's done surveys of young people and he looks at social media and likely voters and voting among different age groups in the country and how elections are run, the amount of money that's being spent. So it's interesting. So if you would like to join our conversation this hour, our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. And we're also on Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and you can find us on Twitter as well, and that's @KDunnShow. Professor Darren Liliker, thank you very much for being with us. Good evening, sir.
Good evening. Good afternoon.
Whatever it is.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. You know, it is amazing. We're looking, as you probably know, at somebody, Rand Paul, announcing today that he's running for president. We are a year and a half away, and we've been talking about our presidential race for a long time now. You don't do that where you are. Why? Why are you reasonable about this?
Well, I suppose it's because of the party system mainly. So, you know, we're electing a party, and over history, I mean, this is the first year we've had a fixed term for a government. So normally the Prime Minister can call an election, and it actually benefits a Prime Minister to have the election as quickly as possible. So he can, or he historically could, just call the election and say, right, 6 weeks' time, that's voting day, we're off. And all his opponents will then start panicking. So not always that civilised, but you know, it's part of our tradition as was. But David Cameron changed that.
Mm-hmm. And you have elections on May 7th. Is that the day?
That's correct. Yes. Yes.
So if you were watching television or listening to radio in Britain, would you be hearing announcements? Would you be hearing political ads or not?
Not political ads, no. We do have the party election broadcasts. So each of the top parties have two election broadcasts they are given, and the minor parties can be allowed one. We had the Conservatives tonight. So over the course of the election, it'll probably be most nights there will be a party election broadcast, but that's one at a set time on the two major channels, BBC One and ITV. Sometimes they're repeated during the night, but that's the only one. There's no advertising. There's no. There are posters. There are other things around the campaign. The main thing with the election here is the news. That's where we hear about the election campaign and what they're doing.
And when you have a party broadcast tonight, what does that encompass?
Well, tonight's was the Conservative Party, and it was actually very positive for a change. But very positive, which is unusual. They tend to be quite negative in the campaigning. And they were setting out really what they'd achieved over the last 5 years as the incumbent government, and what they promised to do for the future. And David Cameron at the end said how much he cared about families and children. So that was really them setting out their stall. So the first one of the election campaign, a good time to do that. It'll get dirty as it goes on, though.
How so?
Well, it's a very close election. The polls are... Labour and the Conservatives are neck and neck. It seems very, very likely we'll have a hung parliament and it'll be another coalition. So both parties are seeking the advantage over the other. And every personality issue, every mistake, every policy issue that they can pick on, they will pick on. And what they will be trying to do at the same time as say how good they are is unpick everything their opponents are doing. And negative campaigning is often easier. It's much easier to attack and lay the seeds of doubt in voters' heads than it is to have your positive message accepted.
And will people watch in great numbers those presentations on television?
No, they don't watch them in great numbers, no. They're usually put on at times when people are going to be around, so it's after the main evening news bulletin. But viewing figures tend to be low, and we often expect that viewing figures, as for all adverts, are slightly inflated as many people disappear off, put the kettle on, have a comfort break, things like that. So. You know, and as it's on the on BBC, there's no adverts at all on the BBC. So, You know, it's a good time.
We spend, who knows how much we'll be spending in the 2016 race, an estimated $6 billion spent by candidates, parties, and outside groups in the 2012 U.S. election. How much will you be spending in this 2015 election?
Oh, well, a minuscule amount in comparison. They're only estimates. I had a look at some of the sites, and you look at some of the donations, and it's, 250,000 is one of the highest donations from the trade unions of the Labour Party. Probably the parties will be spending $2-3 million.
That's
if they can get that amount of money.
$2-3 million. And are there restrictions on how much money you can put in and how you can put it in?
There's no restrictions on how much can be put in. The restrictions are that you have to publicly declare anything. I think it's over. Ooh, what's the threshold? I think it's over £5,000. It has to be declared, I think. So you have to declare that and be open about it, which is good to some extent. It prevents some, I suppose, concerns that there's money travelling in the background. But there are no real restrictions. I think the reason is that people don't want to invest as much in politics. It's not the tradition. It's not the done thing. And so, you know, parties tend to be running campaigns on quite small amounts of money here.
Mm-hmm. And you wrote this, I believe, or somebody wrote this. I was reading about the election. Labour and Conservatives may collectively, in your May election, win only 60 to 65% of the vote. So then what?
Well, I think if David Cameron wins 55% of the vote, he'll be very, very happy.
Hmm.
I mean, like America, the number of the number of votes does not equate the number of seats in Parliament or the number of the votes the president gets in terms of the states and how he wins. So, across the country, in each of our constituencies, which, you know, for sort of, you know, think states is the easiest way. Many of them turnout is between 50 and 70%, very few over 70%. But you could have 5, 6, 7 parties standing, so the vote can be split, and the person with one more vote than then his closest rival wins.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a situation where the Liberal Democrats, for example, they had 25% of the national vote, but in Parliament they only had 59 seats. I think it's 8% of the total seats. So, you know, those sorts of things are, I guess, problems with the system in themselves.
Mm-hmm. You've done a survey. You do a lot of surveys, but you found recently across all voters, is this right? Only 7.6% of those you surveyed have no intention to vote, will not vote. That's pretty low, isn't it?
It is. One thing, it could be an artifact of polls that people who are willing to sign up to a polling register online are also perhaps more willing to participate in other things. But we also had a group in there that were uncertain whether they were going to vote and uncertain who to vote for. So how they will move. But to be honest, the people who say they definitely will not vote is often a smaller number than those who do not vote in the end.
I see. And you've looked quite a bit at the 18 to 24-year-old vote, which in this country tends to be traditionally low in turnout for voting. Is that true in Britain as well?
It is, yes. Yes, it is. And it's one of those things that concern us a great deal. And then the reason we did the recent poll was because we're focusing much more on young people and their issues in a art of election special at Bournemouth University, but it's a problem that they're not engaged, they don't feel parties talk to them, and parties don't talk to them because they don't vote.
Right.
So we have a kind of vicious cycle there, and that's possibly the same in America, that you know, the parties focus on those people most likely to vote, and you'll hear far more said about pensions and the NHS and those big things that concern or are most important to perhaps an older generation than a younger generation.
And yet it's not as though they are not politically involved, right?
Oh, no, it isn't. But their ways of getting involved are, I think they're very different, and I think this is something that Barack Obama tapped into quite successfully in 2008. I don't think it worked as well in 12, but he didn't have that unique factor then. But young people have this different repertoire of engaging with politics. They want to, they do things online. They want to connect directly. They want to have a direct impact. And they see that as far more likely if they're involved with NGOs, that they will sign, they will promote petitions for a wide range of both local and multinational organizations, like Greenpeace to, you know, a local Dorset company here. You know, they're very active in doing those things. They like to buy responsibly where they can afford to. But getting involved with parties is something that is not part of what they do, and they don't see why they should and why it's relevant to them. And that's becoming a problem. And the concern is, of course, over their lives, that connection with electoral politics will be eroded completely.
And are they more liberal than other people you've polled, other age groups you've polled?
No, they don't appear to be different in their political ideas. A lot of their causes are a lot more humanitarian, perhaps. But I wouldn't say they're more liberal across all the issues. You will find, I mean, one of those strange things that we see with polls, that the people who still support capital punishment, there's a big gap in the middle of the life cycle that people say no. Older generations and younger people say yes. There is qualifications. So things like that, that's quite surprising. But it's one of those things with, I think, the way that the media talk about certain events, it promotes that sort of thing. But I don't think they're naturally more liberal. I think it's more that they're more humanitarian, that they're more interested in those big global concerns than the local ones.
I know your studies, your research, and your teaching centers on what's happening in Britain, but you must have some thoughts about how long our presidential campaigns are and the fact that people are already announcing now, and many more will in the next 3 or so weeks, for an election that's a year and a half away. Isn't that crazy?
Well, it's the way things are done, and to build up the funds they require, they have to. When we had the non-fixed term parliaments, you know, the leader of any party could call an election, but they would already have money in their funds. They would be pulling money together, and they would know how much they would need to run election campaign. They would still be looking for money, but the leader had been in place, and the leaders would be trying to pull in money, trying to encourage those organisations that support them to pull in money that they could use. For a presidential candidate, they are there starting their campaign pretty much from scratch. They can't go and dip into all the funds of the party. They have to go out and get supporters. And so to announce now, and then they have to go out and be very, very good fundraisers. And so it makes logical sense for the way that the American elections work.
We welcome phone calls for our guest. Dr. Darren Liliker is Associate Professor of Political Communication at Bournemouth University. He does a lot of work in professionalization, the marketing, strategic development of political communication, and the impacts on citizen engagement. Britain is having major elections on May 7th, and really the campaign season has only been in full swing for a fairly short period of time. So we thought it would be interesting, as we're talking about politics so far in advance of a major election, is there a better way to do this? Why does Britain do this the way they do? It's obviously a different form, a parliamentary system than what we have. But is there some kind of model that we ought to be looking at that would not involve the huge sums of money and all of the time and effort on the part of the many people who are running? Is there a better model? Or just because we're interested in what other models are, and assume that many of you may be as well. So if you'd like to join our conversation, the number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and you can find us on Twitter as well, at K Dunn Show. We'll talk more about the political parties in Britain, and we'll be looking at what some of the issues are in this general election as well, because we're all part of the same planet and have close ties, of course, with Britain. So we welcome your phone calls and participation in a moment. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Welcoming your phone calls. We're talking about the general election in Britain and how it differs, their whole campaign season, than ours, why they are different, is a model that we should emulate in some way. And we're looking at what some of the issues are for this big election in Britain. And welcoming your phone calls. We'd love to have you join us. 800-486-8655 is the number. Do you think that we should follow a model of just have campaigns be 6 months, that you can only do television ads, you can only campaign for a 6 month period of time, or even less than that, a 1 month period of time, or because of the amounts of money that need to be raised, does it make sense for everybody to start and for the press to start talking about all of these candidates so far out? What system is better? What do you think? 800-486-8655 is the number. I was wondering about this issue of the European Union. I noticed that the ex-labor Prime Minister Tony Blair has been in the news lately here, warning that David Cameron's pledge to hold a referendum on Britain's EU membership would cause economic chaos. Is this a big issue in this particular race?
Well, it's probably a bigger issue this time than it has been in the past. But whether it's a really big issue with voters is open to question. We have one party that has been campaigning for many years for a referendum or Britain to leave the European Union, which it believes would be the outcome of a referendum. And so they've really pushed it onto the agenda following the European parliamentary elections here, which they won. But when it comes down to a general election, it's much more about the country. And while there may be a dissatisfaction with certain elements of Britain's embassy, the European Union, it is not as important as some of the other issues, the economy, jobs, the NHS. These are things that people really value and see as important. And I think those are the things that are likely to switch certain people. Those people who have who see that the European Union is the biggest issue, that's something they will be very concerned about. But I think largely it may be dropping off people's radar when they think about the election as it gets close to voting day.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to some phone calls for you. We start with Jeannie in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Hi, Jeannie.
Hi, Kathleen. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm good. I'm very excited with what you're talking about, because as our country gets more and more polarized with the people that have money and the people that don't, I'd really like to see one of your suggestions, the limits in the amount of money that's able to be spent and the amount of time. But I would like some constraints on the amount of money so that someone who works their way up from the general populace can still become a president instead of just one of the 1% land that people that have already the landed and moneyed people of that 1% that are running our country, so that someone who can run, come up through the ranks, could afford to do the same kind of candidacy run that the big moneyed people can.
Dr. Lilliker, can you make a across the pond comparison here? Do you have a pool that tends to be fairly wealthy, fairly connected of candidates?
Well, I mean, if you look at our current government, that they're a pretty elite bunch. You know, that they have the top level of education. Many come from quite a privileged background. So, I wouldn't say that we have a much more egalitarian system. It's in theory, anyone can become a member of parliament. Anyone can become a member of the cabinet, anyone could become prime minister. But in reality, a lot of in Britain, perhaps, you know, much more than America, there is an old boys network. It's who how connected somebody is that can get you into politics. So I wouldn't necessarily say that the money issue is something that makes a big difference. Still, there is a certain elite that dominate.
Mm-hmm. And Jeannie, let me ask you.
The United States is that education is becoming more and more expensive, and therefore, again, that polarization of who can afford to get educated to become one of the well-educated people, and it's being regulated by, like, Scott Walker, who is, I feel, in the pocket of big business. So it's just generating more and more polarization between the people who possibly could get educated and then get into those candidacy positions.
And yet Scott Walker is an interesting case in point, Jeannie. No matter what you think of his politics, he is touting himself, and it seems to be playing pretty well. He's a middle-class guy who's not like the others, whose family doesn't have a lot of money. He's not worth very much money, and he's made his way to the top tier of candidates.
Well, and he's trying to market himself as another Ronald Reagan-esque sort of fellow, mm-hmm. And I just see him as being much more associated with the moneyed and the 1%, and not looking more at what the state and the education and our future potential with the students and what's coming next besides himself.
Thank you, Jeannie, very much for the call. Dr. Lilliker, could you give me a rundown again of the all of the parties, all the political parties? We tend to focus on the major ones because we have the Republicans and the Democrats, and third-party candidates don't get announced, don't get a whole lot of coverage. But you have some growing, not major parties, don't you?
Well, we do, yes. So just think about the main contenders for the forthcoming election. We have the two major parties that are competing to be the party of government. That's Labour and the Conservatives. We have the Liberal Democrats, which were formerly the Liberal Party, which merged with a wing of the Labour Party in the 1980s. They're currently part of a coalition government, but quite a small party. We have the UK Independence Party, which is really campaigning for Britain leaving the European Union.
Mm.
We have a Green Party, which has one member of Parliament. And then we have two, I suppose you really call them regional parties, Scottish and Welsh nationalist parties, which have been campaigning previously for their own parliaments. I'm sure you heard the things about the Scottish independence referendum. That was led by the Scottish National Party. So we have those parties. There's lots and lots of other parties around, but they don't stand everywhere, and often they're standing just to gain a little bit of media coverage. But they would be the major parties. Northern Ireland, of course, has its own parties. So the Democratic Unionists, Sinn Féin, the traditional Unionist Voice, the Ulster Unionists, and there is another party, the SDLP, the Scottish, the Social Democratic and Labour Party.
Mm.
So I hope I've covered all of those. If not, somebody who's expert in Irish politics will be ringing in. But yes, it's a little bit more complicated, but really it's been a two-party system for many years. And I think the last couple of elections have shown that it's perhaps now sort of a two-plus party system. In Scotland, very much becoming dominated by the Scottish Nationalist Party, which was usually a Labour stronghold. So that's going to affect the Labour Party. It's becoming a more complex environment.
Right. I did follow those elections in Scotland. They were fascinating. I have read that Conservative voters may vote Labour in your election to keep the Scottish National Party out of power. Do you think that may be the case?
I don't think so. I mean, Scotland... I suppose that could be a possibility in some constituents in Scotland, but really to do that, it would be a very local vote switch. Because of the way the constituencies work, if it is a very close race between a Scottish Nationalist and Labour, and there are Conservatives, but there's usually not enough Conservative support there to get a Conservative Member of Parliament, they could choose to play for one of those bigger parties in order to swing the results. So it's possible, but it would be very locally specific.
Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. We're talking about the British elections coming up in May, and they're major elections, but nobody's doing heavy-duty campaigning, and they limit the amount of time that they spend, you know, on television or talking to people about the election. It will be on May 7, the UK general election. Dr. Darren Lilliker is our guest, and he does election analysis and looks at voting trends and young people in voting and breakdown of where people vote and why they vote, etc. He's associate professor of political communication at Bournemouth University and author of a number of books. He has published on political marketing, political communication within digital environments, and exploring the patterns of political participation in the digital age. We just thought it'd be interesting to get a comparison because of the way we do things is so different here in the United States, and some have said maybe it's not the right way. Should we be doing something else, and should we explore how people are doing it elsewhere? So we thought we'd do a show on it. Our number is 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Dennis in Green Bay is our next caller. Hi, Dennis.
Hi. I've got a really crazy idea to throw out there that the candidates couldn't spend more money on their campaign than what the job they're running for pays. And that would keep them from spending billions of dollars and actually make them get out and talk to people. It would level the playing field for all the candidates. But I know it's a crazy idea.
Would you that include the presidency? Because how would you speak to a national audience on that kind of money?
I they did it before they had TV, so get out and campaign.
Thanks, Dennis, very much for your call. It would be, what a difference it would be compared to the way that elections are running right now in this country. That's really hard to imagine. Do jobs in Parliament pay very much? What's the salary, Professor?
Salaries. For a backbencher, I think it's going to be somewhere around $48,000 a year. I think then it goes up to closer to the sort of that 100+ mark for the Prime Minister. It's not the best paid job in the world. No, it has its benefits, but it's not a. Yeah, it's not great pay.
And what are the benefits?
Well, the benefits are really the title. The title of Member of Parliament goes a long way. And so it makes a lot of connections. And businesses like to have a Member of Parliament as part of his executive board, which they would then get a wage for. Because of the connections they have through that. So we have lots of debates about the idea of second jobs and what those second jobs are and how those second jobs influence then how the Member of Parliament does his job and how they would vote.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very thorny issue, but many wages are supplemented. Some Members of Parliament also do lecturing. They carry on their legal careers, jobs of that nature, which is, you know, just keeping their hand in for when they lose their seat.
Right. Thanks very much, Dennis, for your call. Jeremy in Monroe. Hi, Jeremy.
Hello.
Hi. Go right ahead.
There was a show on public radio a while back that talked about the return of investment on campaign contributions, and I believe that the number was something like 1,300% return. And I just think that that kind of money isn't going to just go away, and that there's donors that are just lining up to give their money so that they can reap the reward of their contribution.
When you do an analysis of our system, do you see that potential as well? Does our system seem to be fraught with potential wrongdoing?
Well, I think every system where money is brought in from outside sources is open to some sort of corruption. We had a number of cases in the UK during Tony Blair's time, whether Bernie Eccleston's donations to the party influenced the decision to allow F1 to carry on with tobacco advertising for a couple of further years in the UK. Things like that have always been an issue, and I think the more money is involved, the more people will expect something in return for that. And it's an unfortunate thing to say, I think looking at it, I think a lot of people think that way as well, that there are lots of eyebrows raised of why when somebody is revealed to have given, you know, thousands and millions to a political party. People want to know the question, why? Is it just support, or what are they getting out of it?
Mm-hmm. We haven't talked very much. We talked about television ads and radio ads. What about direct marketing? I know that you have studied this, and also online marketing of political candidates. Is there a great deal of that? Are people having things in their mailboxes and online or not?
A huge amount, yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. First thing the parties are trying to do is get email addresses. That they want to email as many people as possible. So getting people signed up is a real priority. They also use banner ads. They also are using social media. And they also use the data from social media to try and target people. Direct mail is used quite a lot. There's two strands of it. One, that they get one mail out from the local Member of Parliament. But they also use a whole range of direct mailing systems, as well as having people delivering leaflets.
So as a lot of direct mail goes on, and with it being a smaller country and more, it is more accessible. A lot of doorstep campaigning goes on that's kind of under the radar of all of the big national stuff.
And what do you find, as somebody who analyzes all of this, what is most effective, and are there different methods of communication that are more effective with young people than with older people?
Well, yeah, it does seem to be stratified by age, but long-term image is a big issue, and what parties are seen to represent here, it remains constant, and I think that's where you don't get as much of that in the American system. There are people who feel more Democrat, more Republican, but a new presidential candidate can, in a way, rebrand the party. They can build an image around themselves. But here, the long-term attachments to a party. So Labour and the NHS, there is a symbiotic link between the party and the NHS, and they are seen as the party that are most likely to look after that. The Conservatives always seem stronger on the economy, stronger on defence. So you have these long-standing attributes, if you like, that parties have. And those are the things that are very, very important. It's then how they communicate and how they reach people to get that message across and reinforce often the positives or the weaknesses of their opponent. Online is useful for young people, but a great many young people see absolutely no politics on the internet at all because they don't look for it. Their friends on Facebook don't share it. Their contacts on Twitter, they may see a little bit, but Twitter is a constantly moving feed, so easy to miss it. And I think a lot of young people now are very, very savvy about banner ads, that they just ignore them and look at the content they want to.
Yes.
So it's very hard to say what exactly works. Email seems to work, but then that's always to people who have already signed up, because the parties can't email out. Just buy an email address and mail out spam.
Mm-hmm.
You have to sign up and say, yes, you want to receive that communication.
You mentioned the National Health Service. Is that an issue in this general election?
It's a huge issue, yes. With the cuts that the Conservatives have made, there has been lots of bad news about the NHS not meeting targets, long waiting times in accident and emergency. And so this is a real opportunity for Labour to hit against the Conservatives, say what they're doing is wrong. And it is becoming a much bigger issue. And people see the NHS as very, very important. This idea of free healthcare from cradle to grave, it's almost part of the national psyche. It's something we have had since 1947. Everybody really alive has grown up with it and really connects with it. And so how it will be funded with an aging population and a growing population, these are the big problems. But how it will be funded is a big question that parties have to deal with, and people are very concerned about it.
Dr. Darren Littlecur is our guest this hour, and we're talking about the elections in the UK, their national elections, coming up pretty soon now, just a little over a month away. And we got to thinking, well, how different this is, because we really haven't started thinking about those elections until a couple weeks ago when we heard about the elections, whereas in this country we're hearing a lot of today's news cycle is devoted to Rand Paul, who has announced that he is running for president, and last week it was Ted Cruz announcing he was running for president, and in the weeks that are to come, there will be more people saying that they are running for president, and so the process just goes on forever and involves so much money, and it's such a different process in the UK that we thought we would speak to somebody who knows about it to find out how different it is and if it's a better system or it's just more applicable to a smaller country with a different kind of tradition than what we have here. What do you think? We'd love to hear from you. Thanks very much for your call, Jeremy. You can reach the program by calling at 800-486-8655, or you can send an email talk@WPR.org. We'd like to read your comments on Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Welcoming phone calls for Dr. Darren Lilliker, Associate Professor of Political Communication at Bournemouth University, author of Political Communication and Cognition, and we're talking about the national elections in the UK. And our next caller is Eric in Southwest Wisconsin. Hi, Eric.
Hi. I have a comment that I'd like to make. I'm a young voter, and I've been very politically active since long before I could even vote. My mother got me into that. And something that I've noticed is a lot of the comments in news articles online seem to be very biased one way or another. And having done my own research into that, I find that there's coding systems in their websites that set it so that the first person who gets a comment is the first one that's read right underneath the article. And I always read through these comments from top to bottom. And I wonder if it isn't possible that these candidates can, you know, just hire a couple of students to camp these websites and get the first word on any given issue.
Do you have a similar thing? Can you identify with this, Dr. Lilliker?
Well, certainly the practice of astroturfing, I think it's called, of getting people to place comments strategically, get them at the top, is done. To what extent candidates do it, well, no one's ever going to admit to doing those sorts of things due to the ethical nature of it, but you know, there is a sense sometimes that, you know, we know some big corporates have done these sorts of things. There is a sense that these things happen, and you know, the internet, it's kind of, you know, it's the Wild West. You know, all sorts of things happen, whether we like it or not. So you know, very possible that savvy candidates are using whatever means they can to get their message out there.
Thank you very much, Eric, for your call. I guess you don't even, I wonder if you will in this election, I have read that you don't have very many debates either, which I would think would be a very, you know, British kind of thing to do, that you're known for your oratory and Parliament is always spirited and people expressing their opinions. But there won't be debates among the major political parties here?
Well, there has been one major debate between all the leaders of the parties I mentioned earlier.
Right.
So seven leaders got together for one debate. We had a split debate between David Cameron, leader of the Conservatives, Ed Miliband, leader of Labour, mm-hmm. where they were interviewed, and they called it a debate. And there's going to be a debate between the opposition debate, they've called it. So the party leaders of the non-governmental parties are taking part in the debate, but David Cameron, in a way, was allowed to define the rules for it. He argued that there should only be one debate, and he argued it should involve as many of the other party leaders as possible. And he did, personally, I think. Seem a little bit afraid of the prospect of a head-to-head debate with Ed Miliband on TV, which is slightly surprising because he is the much better performer usually. But he did seem to be a little nervous about it, and his refusal, but his proposals were accepted as a good alternative, and so he was allowed to kind of get away with that, which I think is disappointing. I think it would be good to see a lot more debates and the party leaders be forced to answer a few more questions, both from voters and from one another.
A debate among seven people doesn't give anybody much of a chance to speak, does it?
It didn't really, no. There was some very, very good work done by the lady who was moderating the debate for ITV. But they all, and they all had their say, and I think it was very, very fair and equal. But there wasn't that real chance of interrogating one another,
mm-hmm.
of really picking up a point and making them answer how they're funding certain things. And, you know, and the major party leaders particularly, you know, they are there making proposals, but they don't really want to be too specific about how the funding is moved around, what is going to be cut to ensure this happens. And so those are the things that they really need to be tested on. And I think a debate would have been a good place for that.
Let's go to John in Milwaukee next. Hi, John.
Hi. I've got a couple of things that would show profiteering from being in office. Hunter Biden supposedly became vice president of the Ukraine oil company after we took over the Ukraine or overthrew their government. Tony Blair made hundreds of millions of dollars selling weapons in the Middle East and for, you know, to reward for going to war, you know, with our President Bush. And Adelson, like, gave $25 million to that white-haired candidate for president and a couple of 8 years ago. And he's a big gambling Macau and China gambling executive, and as well as in Nevada. And that's the money like that. If the person gives that money, they can write the script for that candidate, and the candidate will be propagandizing the ideas of the guy that gave him the money. Chelsea Clinton got married to a Goldman Sachs executive, and they spent $25 million on the wedding reception.
They did? $25 million?
At least
you
that
sure
much,
about
yeah.
that? How in the world can you spend that much money
so
on a wedding reception?
There's benefits for being a kowtow to the moneyed interests in this country.
Dr. Lilliker, and he mentioned Tony Blair as well. Same true in the UK?
Well, yeah, as I said, yeah, there are always these days when money's around, and yeah, sure, you know, we have all these worries. I'm not sure there's ever been anything proven about Blair selling arms. He was employed as a peace envoy, which may well sound as bizarre as him selling arms. But money is an issue in politics, and separating it out of politics is very, very difficult. And where there is money changing hands and deals being made, we can look at it and we can ask very legitimate questions about how this really works and is something a little bit dodgy going underneath. We don't know. We don't know, and that is part of the problem.
So from your knowledge of our system and your knowledge of your system, will you take your system of elections any day over ours?
I think that the biggest problem with the American system, I quite like our election campaigns. You know, they are low-key, but they're all so short. And I've heard from friends, particularly in swing states in like New Hampshire, you know, where they're getting this constant barrage of telephone calls and emails and leaflets and people knocking on their doors. And I don't think I could cope with that. You know, after 6 weeks, I've wholly had enough. I want to know what the result is. I want to get on with my life. and just that thought of, because I was doing the research, I signed up to Obama's campaign. And just the number of emails a day was astonishing.
Yes.
It's. I think for that reason alone, I could do without it. But it's whatever. I do not want to say one system is better than the other, but I think I'd have had enough.
Yeah, I'm with you. Thank you so much for being with us. We really appreciate it.
It's been great. Thank you very much.
Our pleasure. Dr. Darren Lilliker, he's Associate Professor of Political Communication at Bournemouth University, and he is author of Political Communication and Cognition. We thank him for being with us to give us a look at what the issues, some of the issues are in the UK election and how they go about everything so differently than we do here. Is it a better way? was the question of the hour. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing the hour, and thanks to KP as well for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. News is next, then Billie Holiday.